What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends, Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff, in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know, the lawyers in the house.
Welcome in, Legal Face-Off, WGN Plus, from the Tribune Tower in Chicago, Illinois. Rich Lenkoff back in the studio. He is in-house, no longer on the phone. Rich, good to be back.
Back from the coast.
Jason Whiteside is here per usual. I am Sam Panionovich. We've got three guests for you today. We've got the legal grab bag at the end. Breaking news, Dennis Hastert related, so we'll get to all that. But first we go to the phones. There's a lawsuit involving the CIA, and the ACLU is all over it. Dror Layden is a staff attorney for the ACLU National Security Project, and he joins us now in Chicago on WGN Plus. Good morning.
Good morning.
Dror, thanks for joining us on Legal Face-Off. Tell us about the lawsuit brought on behalf of three individuals over their torture endured in a secret CIA prison, or at least that's the allegation.
Sure. So these are three men who are named in the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on CIA torture as victims of the CIA's torture program. And they're suing the two psychologists named James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, who were, as independent contractors, responsible for designing and implementing the torture program for the CIA and made millions of dollars doing so.
All right. And, you know, what's in the news, too, Dror, about this is that there's been a shift with the Obama administration. Previously, they'd shut down any type of these lawsuits that would sue directly for this torture. But now you guys, the government's not putting up that barrier, right?
Yeah, it's totally unprecedented. So in every previous CIA torture lawsuit, the government immediately intervened and asserted something called the state secrets privilege and basically said that the whole issue of CIA torture was too secret for courts to deal with and sought dismissal of every lawsuit. And in this case, instead, the government filed a statement of interest on April 8th in which it said that it was considering special procedures that would allow the lawsuit to move forward. And in fact, we just had a hearing last Friday on April 22nd, and the government appeared in court and did not seek to shut the lawsuit down. It was a hearing on a motion to dismiss, and the government was just there to talk about how they would enable discovery to take place and under what circumstances and what procedures.
So why? Obviously, the question is, why is this shift on behalf of the Justice Department to now not invoke the state secrets privilege?
Sure. You know, the biggest reason for it is probably the release of the Senate Intelligence Committee's report. And it's an exhaustive report on CIA torture. And in order to get the executive summary of it, which is about 500 pages, publicly released, they got a lot of information about the CIA's torture program declassified. So there's no real argument that it's a state secret anymore. And so whatever, you know, whatever the Justice Department said in the past about the secrecy of the program just can't tenably be said at this stage.
So now, Dror, all these secrets, or quote-unquote secrets, that the State Department or the government was holding on torture, they're out in the public then, right? Or at least they're able to be obtained by you guys.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think there might be some discussion at the margins about whether every last, you know, shred of information involving the program is public, but certainly, you know, there's no real argument that lawsuits now can't proceed because the entire program is secret. So, I mean, just to give you an example, the report both names our clients, you know, describes what happened to them, acknowledges that the CIA had this torture program. So it's sort of a very different landscape in terms of actual government acknowledgement than existed prior to this case. That's not to say that there's no classified information at the margins and that there won't, you know, perhaps be discovery battles about that. But certainly, you know, we believe that everything we need to win this case is now in the public record.
Dror Layden with the ACLU joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus. So you're seeking monetary damages on behalf of these individuals, at least one of which died because of the torture. That's what you allege, correct?
Yeah, and again, you know, this is it's sort of an interesting lawsuit in that so much of it is already in the public, you know, the information underlying it. So, yeah, the Senate report describes the circumstances under which one of our plaintiffs died under torture.
That was Ghul Raymond. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that
Rahman.
Right. But Rahman, got it. Okay.
Yeah.
What happened to him?
So it's pretty horrifying. You know, he was, after being beaten and starved and, you know, enduring some really bad abuse, he was then shackled to a very cold floor and forced to sort of be what they called short-chained on that floor, naked overnight after having been dehydrated and starved. And the CIA's autopsy said that he died of hypothermia due to exposure while being naked on the floor after his body had been already so weakened by the torture and deprivation he had undergone. So it's a pretty graphic description.
All right. And so these two individuals, these were private contractors, Jessen and Mitchell, that were hired by the CIA, essentially hired by the government, right?
Yeah, I mean, they entered into a contract with the government. You know, in our complaint, we describe, and again, you know, we got it from the Senate report itself, how the two of them sort of developed this theory that they were going to use a psychological concept called learned helplessness. And they had this theory that they could torture prisoners into breaking them down mentally and emotionally enough that they would then become totally compliant. And it was based on this totally pseudoscientific theory that was based on experiments that had been conducted on dogs in the 60s. I mean, it was pretty out there. But they, you know, they managed to get the CIA, and there were people in the CIA who were pretty enthusiastic about it. And you know, that's sort of the genesis of the torture program. And then they further refined it and developed it. But yeah, they were operating as independent contractors the entire time. Eventually, they put together a company that contracted with the federal government to run the torture program. And that company, the Senate report discloses, was paid $81 million of taxpayer money.
Drew, have you found any connection of direction or control between the CIA and these contractors? Or is it pretty much the opposite, that these contractors operated independently of the government?
You know, I think they certainly worked in collaboration with the CIA. They weren't, you know, they weren't running the torture program all by themselves with no buy-in from the government. I think, you know, there's real questions as to who in the government, once you go high enough, was actually authorizing things and was actually, you know, being briefed. And there's a lot of questions as to whether the White House or, you know, much less Congress were actually receiving briefings about what was happening. But certainly there were, you know, plenty of people within the CIA who were deeply involved in
so
the torture.
Why are you not suing the CIA? Why are they not a party to this?
Sure. I mean, we have sued the CIA in the past, and you know, there may be other actions against the CIA. In this case, it was largely built after the Senate report disclosed Mitchell and Jessen's involvement. And there's something about, you know, their profiteering and the fact that they made $81 million for this that puts them in sort of a different category than, you know, anyone who is drawing a government salary to, you know, to do their job. That said, you know, I do think that there may be, you know, it may be appropriate and it may be necessary for certain people within the government to also face accountability for this. And it's too bad that has not happened yet.
But is the allegation you're complaining, forgive me for not having a chance to read it in detail or even the Senate report. So this might be obvious if you had read it, but is the allegation that these two individuals were working somehow on their own without direction by the CIA? I mean, obviously, it sounds like it would be common sense that these two wouldn't be engaged in these interrogations or torture, as you call it, on their own, right? I mean, they obviously were working for the federal government. So would it stand to reason that the real target of the lawsuit shouldn't be these two people, even though they did profit to the degree of $81 million, I think you said? I mean, isn't the ultimate target and isn't the ultimate party responsible the federal government?
I mean, certainly the CIA is responsible for its torture program. In no way do I want to suggest that Mitchell and Jessen were out there on their own. But I don't think that Mitchell and Jessen, you know, as the chief profiteers of the torture program and as the people who designed it and sold it, I don't think that left them off the hook in any way. And, you know, and I do think that it's appropriate that the CIA does, you know, that people do pursue accountability against people within the CIA and against other decision makers. But I just don't think that you know, that lets Mitchell and Jessen off the hook by any stretch. And you know, I can't speak to future lawsuits or different lawsuits against others within the CIA.
Drew, did the government waive their immunity in this, or are they still? I know you said they had basically they're not blocking the lawsuit from proceeding forward, but have they waived any sort of immunity claim that they might have?
Well, they're not a party to the lawsuit, so their immunity hasn't been put at issue. I don't believe they have waived any kind of immunity. I think with them, just the main change is that they're no longer seeking to block these kinds of lawsuits, whereas previously they'd tried to block lawsuits whether or not they targeted the government. So
presumably, the defendants, the two psychologists, will argue that they had some sort of immunity because they were agents of the CIA. I would imagine, right?
Well, yeah, and actually, so, we had a motion to dismiss hearing on Friday in which that's precisely what Mitchell and Justin argued. They said that they were entitled to what they called derivative sovereign immunity as a result of their contract with the CIA. But as we argued and as the judge accepted, the Supreme Court has actually very recently spoken specifically on contractor immunity, and they've said there is no such thing as derivative sovereign immunity whereby private contractors are able to cloak themselves in the government's immunity. The law does draw a distinction between contractors and government employees, and while sometimes there are circumstances under which contractors can take advantage of certain government immunities, there's nothing automatic about that. And certainly, this is not a case in which we believe the defendants have a good claim to immunity. And the judge refused to dismiss the case on immunity grounds.
Drew, one last question with about 60 seconds we have left on Legal Face-Off. Donald Trump, obviously, looks like he's going to be the Republican nominee. Had a big day yesterday, has come out very forcefully and said that he's in favor of reinstituting techniques like waterboarding. If he is elected president, he said that he would do things even worse than waterboarding. Now, the director of the CIA has come out and said that he wouldn't follow that order. Where does the ACLU stand currently on the use of these techniques?
Oh, we unequivocally oppose them. I mean, they're completely in violation of both our domestic law and international law. They violate, our country's core commitments for hundreds of years, and certainly, the commitments we made in the Geneva Convention and the Convention Against Torture. I think the fact that torture is at all even considered something that people can debate or talk about whether we should or shouldn't do it as a policy matter suggests just how far we have to go on accountability. Because unless we actually really shut the door to torture by having lawsuits and having people account for having actually created a torture program in the United States, people are free to sort of talk about it. And that's very disturbing. They're talking about violating, our core commitments.
Drew Layden, we appreciate your time. Staff attorney from the ACLU National Security Project. There's a blog, ACLU.org/blog. We appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Welcome back, Legal Face-Off on WGN+. One guest down, two to go. We bring in Professor Michael LaRoy from the School of Labor and Employment Relations and College of Law, University of Illinois. So we go down I-57 and find him in Champaign. Is Tom Brady suspended? Is he not suspended? Well, the ruling yesterday that the four-game suspension is reinstated, so we welcome Professor to WGN+. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. Professor, you're an expert in labor relations. Was this really a case about a contract alone? Could it really only be about a contract?
Well, for purposes of what the court was looking at the other day, it is primarily about the collective bargaining agreement between the Players Association and the league. But, of course, you've got this celebrity aura around this, starting from the moment that the Brady pass was intercepted, and soon thereafter the whole controversy erupted. So it's an odd mix. It's a mundane legal case that's wrapped up in this playoff environment and everything that is spectacular about the NFL.
Right. So the court, just to be specific, the U.S. Court of Appeals reinstated the four-game suspension that was previously overturned. This was a three-judge panel of the United States Courts of Appeals for the Second Circuit. And it looked at, as you mentioned, whether Roger Goodell has the authority or had the authority to suspend Tom Brady over Deflategate. And the judge, in my opinion, very correctly found that Commissioner Goodell had that authority. It's not about whether Tom Brady was guilty or innocent, although that obviously had some play, but simply a matter of whether the head of the NFL had the ability to do what he did. Yes?
Well, that's my view of it as well.
Do you think the judge was right?
Oh, I think this panel that just ruled is correct. There were two judges who said that the commissioner had broad discretionary authority and exercised the authority within the purview of the CBA. And I think it's very important to keep in mind that the players agreed to this procedure. It's not a novel arrangement. It has been in their collective bargaining history since the inception of that collective bargaining relationship. So it is understandable that it would come up in this rarefied context of you have a Hall of Fame quarterback and the bad blood between the commissioner and the NFLPA. All of that makes sense. But legally speaking, I think it's a no-brainer. The contract provides this authority. The commissioner never deviated from the authority. There was an investigation that, to the best extent possible, was independent. And so the outcome is what we have here. The court is affirming the arbitrator's ruling.
And it's I mean, listen, the court said very appropriately that we shouldn't even be involved. I mean, if you, Tom Brady, don't like the meaning, the language of the agreement that you and your union agree to, then take it up in that forum. Don't use and waste the court's time in deciding whether this could happen. I mean, the proper forum for this dispute is the collective bargaining agreement, right?
That's exactly right. And making this even more interesting, let's not forget that Tom Brady was the lead plaintiff back in 2011 challenging the same commissioner and his authority to impose a lockout under the National Labor Relations Act. And almost in an eerily similar way, Brady won at the first level, the district court ruling. He won in 2011 when the lockout was enjoined, but later the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals lifted that injunction and said it was appropriate at this stage of the bargaining for a lockout to occur. And, eerily again, you have the initial court looking at it saying that the commissioner did not have authority to do it, but on second look, the Court of Appeals is saying that the commissioner was well within his powers to do so.
Sources close to Brady still believe he's going to appeal. It's probably a much more uphill battle this time around. What are those chances that he can appeal and possibly win it now that it's been reinstated, the suspension?
Well, he does have several avenues of appeal. He can ask for what's called en banc review, and that would essentially mean all of the appellate judges in the Second Circuit would vote on the case and decide the case.
Including Chief Judge Robert Kartsman, who was the lone dissent among the three justices who said that he was troubled by the commissioner's decision. So who knows if Kartsman, being the chief judge, would sway the rest of the judges.
You make a very good point. I mean, you can't discount that as a factor in this. And you've had four federal judges take a look at this. and they've come out 2-2. So that certainly could embolden the Brady team to say, let's give it a shot. Why wouldn't they appeal for en banc review? Why wouldn't they go to the Supreme Court if that doesn't work out? But it does beg the question, what is, legally speaking, what is special or unique about Tom Brady's situation? And the answer is nothing. The Supreme Court has ruled over and over again, and most recently in a case involving Steve Garvey, a famous baseball player. It isn't recent per se, but I mean, in terms of the Supreme Court's history, they've looked at these issues. They've looked at professional sports. They've looked at arbitration more broadly. I don't see anything novel here for the Supreme Court to rule on. The only reason they could take it is to somehow craft a ruling that is specific to a major sports league. And frankly, I think they have more important things to do.
Yeah, Supreme Court gets about 10,000 petitions a year. It takes about 700 of them. So, you know, very low percentage. I agree with you, Professor, that this is not the kind of case that would even, you know, get anywhere close to the Supreme Court. Listen, in my opinion, Tom Brady, and I think before I cut you off so rudely, you were going to say that the other options, in addition to Supreme Court, in addition to on-bank hearing, is some kind of settlement. I mean, there's been talk that the league will settle with Tom Brady. It seems like maybe two games would be, you know, a compromise. I think Tom Brady is so deeply involved in this, and I think he is so, his ego won't let him settle. I think you're right. He's going to keep fighting this. He's going to take a shot at least on bank hearing, right? Don't we all agree?
I think we do agree on that. And I don't think Judge Berman, the initial judge who reviewed it, did anybody a favor by trying to mediate a settlement between Brady and Goodell. We know as lawyers that's unheard of for an arbitration case. The whole point of arbitration is to provide an alternative mechanism for parties to contractually arrange for the resolution of their dispute. So anytime you open up an award or the procedure for review, you're basically disincentivizing the parties to keep their initial promise to arbitrate. But to make it worse, you're going to bring in these parties into your chambers and you're going to meet and talk with them. That signals that they are very important people. Well, we know they are, but a court is not supposed to treat a quarterback and a commissioner any differently than a steel worker or a healthcare worker. Fill in the blank. This is labor arbitration, and judges are not supposed to engage in that behavior. So I think Judge Berman put this on the wrong footing from the get-go.
We're on with Professor Michael LaRoy, University of Illinois, School of Labor and Employment Relations. A couple more minutes on WGN Plus. I get the feeling with Brady it's all or nothing. He either gets four games or he gets none. He's not going to take a deal because that's sort of an admission of guilt, isn't it?
It's an admission of guilt, and it would also be an admission that he's able to find common ground with a commissioner with whom he has deep disagreement. And by the way, it may go the other way. Although, looking on the outside in, it seems like Goodell, he might be in a better position to compromise here. I say that because this is an unprecedented case, this idea of tampering with a ball. So I do think the commissioner has a little leeway here. He was pegging the four-game suspension to domestic assault cases, things of that nature. So he was attacked for that by the Brady team, saying, where'd you come up with four? And in the commissioner's defense, he was basically thinking, well, this is the first case I've had like it, and I can't suspend you for the season, but I think it's too important to let it go for one game or two games.
Well, here's the thing. So NFLPA came out yesterday on the Dan Patrick Show and said that if a settlement was going to happen, they would need an owner to spearhead talks between Goodell and Brady. And interestingly, ironically, the person that's best in position to do that is who? Robert Kraft. He's the guy, right? He's like the main owner. Maybe Jerry Jones would take that role, but that's what it would take. But listen, if I was counseling Goodell, I would say do not back down. You can't back down. You can't settle this case because it's much more than deflating balls. People laugh it off as, he was deflating balls. Just like in a lot of crimes we've seen, just like in Watergate. Watergate wasn't a big deal because it was a two-bit crime. It was what? It was the cover-up, right? That's in this case. It wasn't the fact that he deflated balls, although that, in my opinion, is sort of a big deal because it's cheating. It was that Brady purposely, you know, he lied. He lied about the investigation. He covered things up. Yeah. He destroyed his phone. You can't allow that as the head of the NFL, the most, you know, popular brand in the world. You just can't let that happen.
No, if you let that go, then you encourage other players. Look, the NFL deals almost on a monthly basis with serious disciplinary issues. It's just the nature of the game. So if you cut a deal here, you open yourself up for you're already doing these talks, and there are times that the commissioner does make adjustments. But again, you just incentivize people to keep moving the line, and then you get into a crazy world where the commissioner or the next commissioner imposes more discipline in anticipation of settling at the real discipline that he is seeking.
We'll close you out with one question. What are the chances, if you had to put a percentage on it, that he plays before week five?
10% or less. And I say that because I don't think there's a good chance they'll settle, and I don't think there's a good chance he'll prevail on appeal. But it's somewhere slightly above zero. So we'll go with 10%. And that will surely be wrong, but it's a figure that we can talk about for the moment.
Well, we'll write it down in red ink so we can't erase it. Professor Michael LeRoy, University of Illinois School of Labor and Employment Relations, also an author. The book is called Collective Bargaining in Sports and Entertainment, released in 2014. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
We are almost home on Legal Faceoff WGN Plus. Our final guest on this week's show, Arthur Lorigio, professor, Loyola University Chicago Department of Psychology, is on to talk about a handful of things, including the tragic incident with Marcus Gaines and the bystander effect. He joins us now on WGN Plus. Hello.
Hello, how are you today?
Doing great, Professor. Thanks for joining us. So Marcus Gaines, for those of our listeners that didn't follow the story, his family has filed a wrongful death and negligent lawsuit against several businesses and taxi companies resulting from his February 7th death. There's a video that has been widely circulated that shows Gaines leaving 7-Eleven right maybe 2 minutes from where we're sitting right now at WGN. He's talking to some other people before he gets into a confrontation with a man who's wearing a hooded jacket. The man shoves Gaines. The video then shows someone punching Gaines, who then falls to the ground unconscious. Several people, and this is why we have you on, Professor, several people are then seen approaching Gaines. His cell phone and debit card were stolen by a couple of individuals who come running up. And then the video shows people who approach Gaines, who's on the ground, probably unconscious, walking away as he lies there. Several other people walk by him. They ignore him. And then, most tragically, as seen on the video, a taxi turns onto the street where he's lying, runs over his body, and he's killed. So what is the bystander effect, and did that happen in the case of Marcus Gaines?
The bystander intervention effect is one of the most well-established and recognized and replicated lines of research in psychology. There have been hundreds of studies done on the bystander effect, and the studies have documented that three factors can help explain the apparent apathy and inactivity of people who observe a crisis, an incident that involves another person in distress. The first is audience inhibition, and people see a situation that might be somewhat ambiguous. They are hesitant to respond for fear of being embarrassed.
So wasn't this not ambiguous? Wasn't it abundantly clear to any reasonable human being that someone like Marcus Gaines, who's lying on the street, needs help? I mean, isn't that the opposite of ambiguous?
No. If he wasn't crying out specifically that he needed assistance, for example, people could have interpreted it as he's intoxicated. or he might be lying down on the ground for some kind of other prank. Maybe he's doing something with other people that we shouldn't be involved in. So there's some sense of being embarrassed, misreading the situation, and it leads to a state of collective inaction. I think I agree with you that at first glance, you should assume that that's somebody who needs medical help, that's injured or that's incapacitated because of a medical problem. But people walking by quickly, it might not even register as such. And we're afraid of taking a misstep, doing the wrong thing in front of other people to embarrass ourselves. So that might have been an element to apply. Another might have been social influence. Seeing other people's apparent inaction, no one was running out to assist Mr. Gaines, that maybe their own help is unnecessary. When you're alone, you feel responsible for deciding how to respond appropriately in an emergency situation. However, if you're in the presence of other people, witnesses, they seek guidance from the behavior of the group, especially when what you're observing is it's unusual or novel, and you're not sure exactly what's occurring. Emergencies are they don't happen often. They're not something that you observe every day, and it's the misreading of the situation. It can cause individual bystanders to assume that nothing needs to be done. And that fuels the inaction of other people.
You know, Professor, I had a personal story, too, with this. When I moved to this great big city in 2001 from the country, I remember the first time I saw someone laying on the ground, I went to go help them and got screamed and berated by the homeless guy who was just taking a nap. And so I think it's conditioned me, too, ever since then, that, you know, you see someone laying on the ground and you're like, I mean, it's probably, you know, 75% chance they're homeless. Or that's what I assume, and I'm sure that's what other people assume, too.
Well, that was a perfect example of why audience inhibition can have an effect on pushing people away from the assistance of others. And social influence, if you see no one doing anything, you assume nothing needs to be done. And that leads to a vicious cycle that we call pluralistic ignorance, that everybody is misreading the situation all at once and nothing is done. Another factor is diffusion of responsibility. This is a fairly well-trafficked area of the city and street, and if you live in a densely populated area and there's an emergency that occurs there on the street or on the sidewalk, people are going to think that other people are doing something. So bystanders are less likely to intervene in an emergency when others are available as potential witnesses or helpers.
Professor, how much does race play a factor? Marcus Gaines, who was 32 years old when he died, was African-American. This 7-Eleven is right in the heart of River North, an area that is populated by lots of young people. You know, this was, I think, 2 or 3 a.m., lots of people going to, coming from bars, you know, steps from some of the most expensive, or right in the heart of some of the most expensive real estate in the country.
Yes.
How much does race play into it? Some of the people seen on video are Caucasian. Were they afraid of getting involved because of race?
Well, possibly. Recent research on the bystander effect shows that race is a factor, and that people are less likely to respond to people of color, all other things being equal. And the media usually portrays young black men as criminals.
Right. If this was a Caucasian man, same age, dressed in a suit, let's say.
Yes.
Do you think these people would have walked over him the way they did on this video? Probably not.
Unfortunately, I think there may have been a greater likelihood of that. And I really mean, unfortunately, that's the case.
You think there would have been a greater likelihood?
By all accounts, to be a wonderful young man with a bright future.
You're saying if he was white, people would have more likely helped him or not helped him?
Recent studies have shown that.
Right.
And I think it's because that because young black men are stereotyped as being scary, as being criminal, and often in the media, that's how they're portrayed. And the media don't educate the public that it's really poverty that plays a role in propelling people of color into a criminal lifestyle or gang membership. It's really about socioeconomic and cultural factors, not about skin color. But it concerns me most in that we're many years past the civil rights movement, and yet we find in research that there's still a racial effect with regard to how we respond to others in emergency situations. And this anecdote, very tragic anecdote, shows that perhaps race was playing a factor there.
Professor Lorigio, it's ironic, isn't it, that we're told more than ever by authorities, by police, to be alert for, you know, unusual things. If you're at a train, if you're on a bus, on an airplane, at the airport, given everything we've seen in Paris, Brussels, in Europe,
yes,
we're told constantly, if you see something, say something. It's ironic that the bystander effect is still going strong. It's the opposite. The bystander effect, and as seen on this video, is if you see something, do nothing, right? That's what happened here. It's ironic that...
That's an excellent point. And because the bystander effect and the factors that comprise it militate against intervention in ambiguous situations. If you see something unusual, you don't know how to define it. By definition, something unusual is something that you're not accustomed to seeing, something that you're not accustomed to responding to. There's no script for you to act when it's an unusual situation. And the more people around, the less likely you are to get help. If there was no one else around and only one person was in a situation, and Mr. Gaines was still alert and able to cry out very specifically to one person that he needed help. And I think color would have not been a factor. There would have been a greater likelihood that you would get help. Most people believe if I'm in an emergency situation, I want a whole bunch of people to be around me because there's a greater likelihood for me to get the assistance I need. It's the opposite. There's an inverse relationship. The more people, the less likely you'll get help in an emergency. The most likely situation is one person that you can make eye contact with and you can say specifically, I need help. Or you can give that person specific directions. You call 911. I have been beaten. I have been stabbed. I have been shot. Then you're most likely to get help because the ambiguity then goes away. But Mr. Gaines wasn't able to define the situation for people around him.
Arthur Lorigio is a professor of the Department of Psychology at the Loyola University of Chicago. Thank you for stopping by today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And we'll close out Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus, as we always do, with a legal grab bag. And bingo, bango, bongo off the top, we have a civil affiliation, now a criminal one, with Denny Hastert. Jason, breaking news.
Yeah, breaking news. Denny Hastert was in court, is in court right now, and he's sentenced to 15 months in prison for the hush money case, actually for laundering the money or hiding money and lying to a federal investigation. Judge Durkin wrote some pretty harsh comments, though, too. As far as the degree of severity that Denny Hastert went to with these little boys when he was their teacher. But coinciding with that, too, there's also a civil case that the individual A has filed, claiming that he still owed $1.8 million out of the $3.5 million settlement that he and Denny Hastert agreed to quite some time ago. So he's actually filing a breach of contract complaint and hoping to regain or retain the rest of that money. So breaking news.
Yeah, just got back from... Dirksen, I was over
our
there.
Legal federal our, correspondent.
Yes, in the field with the rest of the local media.
With the grainy videos.
Yeah, a couple
took the red line right back just to get
exactly,
here in time.
All the way from the field. A couple interesting things about the sentence today is Zach Farden, who's the U.S. attorney who prosecuted the case against Hastert. He entered into a plea agreement with or a sentencing agreement. Where Hastert would only get 6 months.
Right.
The judge, Durkin, on his own, sentenced Hastert to 15 months. So the press was asking him, and I actually asked Farden a question, whether he looks bad for entering into an agreement that was less than half of what Hastert, you know, ended up getting. Farden, of course, said, no, you know, we're the ones who brought this case, brought justice to the victims. But, you know, interesting that the judge gave Hastert 15 months when Farden only came up with 6 months. You would have thought that Farden would try to throw the book at him more. Hastert was in court. He was in a wheelchair. He looked very frail. The judge asked him point blank, did you sexually abuse Cross? So Tom Cross, who's a local legislator, his brother was one of the victims. We just learned that today. And the judge asked Hastert whether he sexually abused him. And after a long pause, Hastert said yes. Actually, he didn't say yes to Cross.
He just said what I did was wrong and I regret it.
Right. He did admit to, I think it was individual A or D. But he did not admit to Cross. He said it was complicated or some nonsense. But yeah, 15 months, you know, his attorneys have tried to say that he's in ill health and that should weigh in the judge's favor. The judge came down pretty harsh. The judge said if he could have sentenced him to more, he would have.
Yeah, I mean, at the heart of the matter, this is simply just lying to a federal investigation. And he also was, you know, basically convicted or pled guilty to bank laundering.
Well, that was what was interesting, because Durkin today...
This isn't about the... It's not really about the child molesting, but Durkin focused on it today.
Yeah,
I mean, Durkin, he was pretty adamant that all those charges be read and that people are allowed to testify, too, at the sentencing. So.
Right, exactly true. And the reason that Farden, the U.S. attorney, only came up with 6 months was because, going into this, the focus was just on this, you know, monetary arrangement that he violated this bank law. But today, Durkin said that there was more to it, that he was considering the sexual abuse, that he called... Hastert, remember, Hastert was three heartbeats away from the presidency. He called Hastert a serial sexual predator. And he did weigh in the fact that Hastert lied to federal investigators, which he should have. So I thought Durkin got it right.
Yeah.
Is 15 months fair, though, at the end
of
the day?
No, I mean, it's fair given that it was much more than he would have gotten if this was just a straight violation of this federal bank law. So in that respect, it's a great sentence for the victims. But when you consider that this guy sexually abused wrestlers that he was coaching, 15 months is a slap on the wrist, but the statute of limitations ran on that.
There's a lot of people, too, though, that are convicted of the IRS will seize their funds, or the FBI will seize their funds, because they're taking out withdrawals of $8,000, $9,000 in an effort to be under that $10,000 mark. They never do prison time at all. But this, obviously, Denny Hastert, I mean, this is a bigger exposure case, former Speaker of the House, so, and the underlying molestation charges drove this thing to 15 months.
One last thing on the civil case is that, you know, it's almost Hastert was alleging that this was an extortion deal. It's kind of interesting that civilly one of the victims is suing to enforce this deal. You know, his attorney is saying that this is merely an out-of-court settlement like anything else. It's a breach of contract. But it's a little unusual for a hush money deal, someone suing to enforce, you know, a hush money over sexual abuse. It's kind of unprecedented. But you know, to the attorney's point,
it doesn't really matter.
It's a deal.
The underlying basis of it, if it's a contract that he's, you know, Hastert's supposed to pay individual A, and he still owes him $1.8 or $1.7 million.
Apparently he has. I mean, we think he has plenty of money left.
Yeah.
That's what the reports say.
We move from Chicago to Cleveland. One of the first cases we actually covered on Legal Faceoff back in 2014 was the shooting of Tamir Rice, 12-year-old boy that was killed by police gunfire. There is a settlement, multi-million dollars, Rich, $6 million. They're going to try and reward the family with.
Yeah, as Sam mentioned, we've covered the story before. Tamir Rice was playing with a pellet gun outside a recreation center when he was shot by a white police officer. Grand jury declined to bring charges against the police. It sparked protests in Cleveland at the time when a lot of black males were being shot. It sparked a national debate. It became a focal point of the Black Lives Matter movement. So Tamir Rice's estate will receive $5.5 million, $250,000 going to his mother, $250,000 to an unnamed recipient. Importantly, the settlement carries no admissions of any wrongdoing by the police.
Well, did you see the statement that the police department released? It said, we hope that some of these funds are used to educate individuals on the, like, gun safety and not pointing a gun at a cop, essentially.
Yeah.
Not blacking out the tip so that it looks... They said it looked like exactly like a .45 caliber handgun.
Right.
So.
And I was just in New York a couple days ago. William Bratton, who's the commissioner of the NYPD or whatever his title is, he's the top cop in New York. There was a shooting in New York over the weekend and involved a victim who pulled out a gun and was shot, I think, 11 times by the police and killed. Listen, quite appropriately in my mind. And yeah. Bratton's point was, you know what the best way to avoid being shot by police are?
Don't pull a gun out at police. Yeah.
So,
the only... The flip side of it is the only thing they mentioned in the lawsuit, too, was that the cops, apparently, when they arrived on scene, they just came out and started blasting away. But there was also, over the radio, they were told there's someone waving a gun in front of people. So, I don't know. This one's a tough one, and obviously, with being on the plaintiff's side, a suit like this is...
Is what, great?
Yeah.
Awesome.
It's justice.
5 million, yeah. Justice, of course.
Justice, so, in the form of Ben Franklin.
A popular company when it comes to this show, Uber. We bring up Uber quite a bit. Now, there's a settlement.
What is this Uber thing that you speak of?
I've never heard.
Wasn't
of
that our first? It was one of our first stories.
Yeah, you're like, what's Uber?
What's this thing you speak of?
I had a dog named Uber.
I think it was literally our first story.
So
way back when in the histories of Legal Face-Off.
You'll have to go to the vault to get that story.
Go to the...
The archives.
The Hall of Fame, the Radio Hall of Fame for that one.
Uber WGN. Settled class action suits that were supposed to be paying drivers as much as $100 million, but I guess court documents are showing most drivers will probably get about $25 or less.
Yeah, these were just lawsuits.
As it should
states.
Be, by the way, with class actions. Ridiculous.
Yeah. This was for two states, for California, Massachusetts, and these drivers filed a class action saying that they were not independent contractors, but employees. And so the value of the settlement was $84 million, and there could be potentially a $16 million additional payment. But that's tied to Uber going public and their valuation of their stock. So right now it sits at $84 million, with a nice percentage going to the plaintiff's attorneys, I'm sure, and then the rest divided up amongst the class.
But Uber paid it. They paid all this money, but yet there was no resolution on the issue of whether they are, in fact, employees versus independent contractors. That was a big deal. Obviously, Uber did not admit that. If they did admit that, then they would be responsible for all sorts of benefits. And
right.
So, there's
no question that they're independent contractors. They use their own vehicle. They use their own app. They determine when they work, when they don't want to work. I mean, I guess the main point, that the issue that the court will look at, too, is the right to control. And there really is no right to control by Uber against their independent contractors. The independent contractors work whenever they want and how frequently they want.
All I know is that my Uber guys talk to me way too much. I told you on the air that I want to develop the button on the Uber, that the no talk. I'll pay an extra buck if I don't have to.
True, like, story, though.
Yes.
Literally this morning.
Probably
when I was
some
driving
client,
Uber,
some client development for you.
I was on the phone with a client, and the driver asked me what I did, and I told him, and he wants to hire me for an accident, and he's got a friend that was involved, too. So I'll talk to all my Uber drivers.
So, Rich, you need the button on the side of the door.
I may have paid for that ride, but I'm going to make some money off it.
One more thing. You might think $100 million is a huge amount of money. Guess what Uber is currently valued at?
$15 billion. It's a ridiculous,
I think it's like
number.
$50 billion.
Yeah,
it?
It's insane.
50.
Right.
All righty.
That's Whiteside and Goldberg money right there.
Yeah.
So there are going to be some attorneys that are going to be trying to get their hands on Blake Shelton, because he can now sue In Touch magazine. They put a cover out a while back. It was titled "Rehab for Blake." He wasn't happy. The country star now has the green light to go ahead and attack.
Yeah, he had filed suit against In Touch magazine for an article that they wrote claiming that he went to rehab for a drinking problem after a split from Miranda Lambert. Everyone knows that's not true. He's with Gwen Stefani. He's not drinking. But anyway, filed
suit. Upgrade or degrade? Maybe he'll sue. We shouldn't answer that because he might be sued. But
I'm going to stay out of that. But anyway, the defendant In Touch filed a motion to dismiss, which is basically they went into the court and said, hey, there's no way we're protected. There's no way that Blake can win this case. And the judge actually sided with Blake and said, no, he's allowed to proceed and keep going through the litigation process. So it looks like it's headed towards a trial unless there's a settlement reached. But I read the demand was only $1 million.
Yeah.
Or that's what he filed in the complaint, was seeking more than $1 million.
The trend seems to be in favor of celebrities, right? We had the Hulk Hogan. We had the Aaron Andrews.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a trend here. Favorite Blake Shelton song? Crickets.
I couldn't
name any
one.
Blake Shelton song?
Don't think I could name one.
I mean, no, I know three or four, but I can't.
Do you really?
One. Yeah. Well, he's pretty popular
among the country folk like yourself.
Among certain demographics, yes.
Just in case you were wondering, I have the magazine cover. Here are the other three stories. Cutlets on the side. As marriage crumbles, Beyonce is pregnant. Out of control, Demi Lovato's shocking relapse. And wasting away, Scott Disick busted doing cocaine. So those
two
are
out of three are probably true, right?
What about the whole Jay-Z Beyonce rumor? There's a whole thing about
lemonade?
That woman.
Lemonade.
Yeah. Did you get lemonade when it dropped, Sammy?
I didn't
You're
even know what
Beyonce.
It was. Yeah, baby.
Yeah. No, there's a woman who is being accused of having an affair with Jay-Z.
It's Jay-Z's partner's ex-wife, or Jay-Z's
Something
former
like that,
partner's
right?
ex-wife. Damon Dawson. The guy. I think he's on... he's on Shark Tank,
and there's a lyric in the new Beyonce album that apparently references this woman, but she denies it.
Lots of hidden meaning in Beyonce's Lemonade.
Lots of no information on Legal Face Up. By the way, we're like, I might have heard something about someone.
Yeah, if there's anyone out there that can.
God forbid we actually check our facts or know what we're talking about.
We've got two more to go here on the legal grab bag on Legal Face Off WGN Plus. The neighbor of Vanderpump Rules star Sianna Shea. Am I saying that right? Shayana?
I was going to say that's the hardest part of this whole story. Is that she? I think you got it.
S-C-H-E-A-N-A. Sianna Shea has some parties where there's a lot of weed being puffed, and according to a neighbor, they are out of control.
Yeah, thanks to Page Six, we know that her next door neighbor is suing this reality star, claiming that his apartment. It's constantly filled with weed smoke emanating from the unit that Shayana shares with her husband, Michael Shea. This complaint says a plaintiff and his family have awoken on many morning with the sensation of nausea for having inhaled marijuana smoke during the night. And I'll just, obviously this is a big stop, but I'll just say that if that's a crime, then Sammy's neighbors have various complaints
neighbors.
That are probably pending.
I think the complaint for the neighbors is just they want to come over, right?
Yeah.
That's the
you just want to be involved.
Yeah,
with that
why
point.
Don't you invite me?
Right, but her rep shot back and said that the Shays have never received a complaint from a fellow neighbor or building management relating to marijuana smoke stemming from the residence. Notice that she doesn't deny that it's happening, only that they haven't received a complaint. So, I don't know what the damages are, but we'll see what happens with our friend Shayna.
We will close it out with Prince, who passed away at 57, the musical genius, lyrical savant. Didn't have a will, first of all, and the finances are in chaos. The musical legacy is up in the air. There's a lot of questions about the fortune. How dire is the situation after Prince's passing?
Well, Prince's monetary or his estate is obviously huge. I mean, they're estimating it to be one of the biggest estates out there. Someone said that he's got a vault with like 700 unreleased songs. He did not have a will. His sister, his half-sister, I believe, petitioned the court of Minnesota to appoint her as the beneficiary, which is consistent with Minnesota law. It would treat her as the closest relative because Prince's parents are deceased. He doesn't have any children. So she is in line to take over the Prince estate. Prince also had an interesting legal legacy. He was very famous for not releasing his catalog, for protecting his intellectual property. He sued some fans several years ago for releasing his music without his permission. You know, he was notorious for literally sitting there in Paisley Park and trolling YouTube and various social media for seeing if people were violating his intellectual property.
Wow.
Not really the image you want of Prince, but, no. You know, very protective of his music.
And for the legal component of this, too, I mean, every state has an intestacy statute, which just basically means if someone dies without a will, someone is appointed guardian of the estate, and then the money's dispersed according to these statutes, which normally goes to family, close family first, mother, father, brother, sister, wife. Obviously, Prince doesn't have that, no children, so it'll be dispersed amongst his sister and step-brothers, step-siblings.
All right, favorite Prince song. Let's go around the room. Sam?
Raspberry Beret.
Yeah?
Yes.
The kind you find in a secondhand store, that kind?
I wore a raspberry tie to that Hawks game.
Did you really?
The next game, yeah.
It's going to be
Jason
a shock.
Jason Whiteside, favorite?
Purple Rain. The beginning of it, it just does something. It moves me. comes on, and it's such a beautiful song.
I like a less well-known one called I Can Never Take the Place of Your Man. You know that one?
No.
Pretty good one.
Do you want to sing it for us?
Hang on 1 second. Here we go.
Get the tune out of your mouth.
Mike, favorite song back there? Before Your Time? Mike doesn't really know who Prince is. Too young. Mike's coming in with Kiss. What do we think Brian Watercott's favorite Prince song is? Does anyone remember out there Brian Watercott? He's less alive than Prince right now. He's less relevant to our show than Prince, but thank you, Sammy, as usual. Great show.
I was told, by the way, as we let everybody go and say goodbye, Prince, the only man who could steal your woman while being dressed like your woman.
That's it.
Is that accurate?
The only person besides Jason Whiteside.
Thanks to our guests. Thanks to you guys. And thanks to you for listening, WGNplus.com. For anything you may have missed, this is Legal Faceoff. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.